So our speaker today, Travis, he has given me a little list. He's got his PhD from Westminster Seminary. He's also the pastor of his own church in Albany, Georgia, called Northgate Presbyterian. And he's the president of Consider This, a new apologetics ministry, which is really exciting. It's about 6 weeks old, and it's coming along. And he's also coming out with his own book called The Wonderful Decree, which maybe he might mention a little more, but that's also really exciting. So he's got a lot on his plate. So please give a warm welcome to Travis.
We are experiencing technical difficulties, so I'm going to just be speaking to you with nothing on the overhead. For those of you that are wondering, it is all Ross Hoagland's fault. So anything that goes wrong, he is to blame. Now, if this goes off perfectly, we will not blame him. We will praise me. So that is sort of how we're going to go about this. Some of you traveled a long way to hear Hugh Ross speak, and now you're looking at me. No one is more sorry about that than me. I traveled from Albany, Georgia to hang out with the crew at Reason to Believe, come to the Sunday school class and hear Hugh Ross speak. And then when I was asked to teach, I was very upset. I said I wanted to be in the crowd listening to Hugh instead of listening to myself talk. So I do apologize for that, but hopefully we'll have a little fun. I am not a scientist. I'm more of a philosopher, theologian. Just one correction. I'm not the pastor of my church. I am an elder, a ruling elder of my church. Our pastor would like to make sure that that's true. But we're today going to talk about some philosophy, and I was encouraged to give a philosophical argument for God's existence that I it's actually my favorite argument for God's existence. It is a little bit different than some of the arguments that you guys are used to. And so I wanted to share this with you today. As we are thinking about an argument for God's existence, though, or as we're preparing for this, I would like all of you to turn in your Bibles to Colossians chapter 1. And I'm going to be reading verses 16 and 17 in Colossians chapter 1. For by him all things were created, both in the heavens and on the earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things have been created by him and for him, and he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And the verse I'm going to concentrate on is this second verse that I read to you. In him all things hold together. There are actually two ways to argue for God's existence that are called cosmological arguments. I think all of you here have heard of the cosmological argument for God's existence. Raise your hand if you've not heard, caught you, of the cosmological argument for God's existence. The cosmological argument for God's existence reasons from the cosmos or some feature about the cosmos to the conclusion that therefore God exists, or therefore the kind of God worshipped by Christians, Jews, and Muslims exist. And there are really two ways to go about doing this. You can either argue that the cause of the universe is the creator of the universe. Okay. So Hugh Ross and his ministry concentrates on that form of the cosmological argument. Reasons to Believe is dedicated to pointing out certain evidences suggesting that the universe actually began to exist. And because the universe began to exist, It must therefore require a cause for its origination. Some of you are familiar with this argument, right? He wrote a book called Creator and the Cosmos, which really just explores that one apologetic for theism. But there's another kind of argument for God's existence that is also cosmological in character, that argues from a feature in the cosmos to the conclusion not that the universe was created or not that the universe began to exist, but rather that the universe is currently requiring a cause for its existence. Right now, as we speak, we need a cause for our current existence. And this is an illustration, or this cosmological argument is an illustration of what Paul is saying about God, more particularly about Christ, here in Colossians 1:17, that in him all things hold together. Now, the philosopher that was most famous for giving this kind of argument is Thomas Aquinas. Who here has not heard of Thomas Aquinas? Who here has read all of Thomas Aquinas' works? If you have, I would be very impressed. Thomas Aquinas wrote on the order of 200 books in his 50-year lifespan. The titles of the books are less than 200, but he wrote books that were multi-volume. So the Blackfriars edition of the Summa Theologica, his most famous work, is 65 volumes. He wrote a book on truth. It was 7 volumes. He didn't have a lot of TV to watch, and so he just had a lot of time to write. Now, Thomas Aquinas was born in the 13th century. We were not 100% sure of the year that he was born. He was born no earlier than 1220 and no later than 1228, but the dates that most of us give for his birth are around 1224 or 1225. We do know when he died. He died in the year 1274, so he would have been around 49 or 50 years old when he passed away. And in that, again, 50-year lifespan, he was able to produce a massive amount of material. Now, many Protestants shy away from studying Aquinas because at the Council of Trent in the 16th century, when the Catholic Church responded to the Reformation, they literally pulled out the Summa Theologica of Aquinas, laid it open, and basically responded to the Reformers by quoting wholesale from Thomas's work. And therefore, since then, Protestants have had sort of a bad taste in their mouth whenever Aquinas has come up. But it does turn out that, as one historian informed me, an expert in this field, he said, the Reformation is really Reformed Thomism. What many of the Reformers did is they took Thomas's metaphysical views and his view of God, and they bathed that in what I would call the cleansing waters of the Reformation, so that a consistent understanding of sola gratia, grace alone, was wedded to Thomas's understanding of reality. And you see Thomas's understanding of God and reality coming through in various confessions of faith, including the Confession of the Presbyterians, the Westminster Confession of Faith, and later the Reformed Baptists, the Confession of 1689. So Thomas is incredibly important, not only for Roman Catholics, but he's also extremely important for Protestants. Well, Thomas was aware of arguments existing in the 13th century whereby people tried to argue that the universe had a beginning. A contemporary of his named Bonaventura was given precisely those kinds of arguments in Thomas's day. But Thomas was not convinced that you could prove that the universe had a beginning. I believe, although I don't know this, that Thomas would be elated over discoveries that have been made in the past 100 years in the area of astronomy, to the conclusion, of course, that the universe had a beginning. As Hugh Ross has told all of you on multiple occasions, most scientists living before the 20th century thought that the universe was infinite and eternal. And out of literally nowhere, a patent clerk writes out some scribblings called the General Theory of Relativity and then the Special Theory of Relativity. And these relativity theories pointed to a beginning of the universe. And then in 1929, Edwin Hubble observes the expanding universe, and from there we go on to realize that this universe must have had a beginning. Thomas did not have the benefit of those scientific discoveries, so the only kinds of arguments for an origin of the universe that were bandied about in the 13th century were philosophical in character. Now, I'm not going to get into those philosophical arguments except to say that Thomas just didn't think that those arguments worked. So when Thomas argued for God's existence, he presupposed, for the sake of argument, that the universe never had a beginning, that the universe has always been here, that the universe is eternal, in other words. In other words, he granted the very premise that atheists have always believed, that out of nothing, nothing comes, and therefore, the world is eternal. So where did the universe come from? The atheist will tell you it didn't come from anywhere. It's just there, and that's all, in the words of Bertrand Russell. Thomas took that premise and showed that God exists anyway. So I kind of like this. He argued for God's existence with one hand tied behind his back and still proved that there was a God. Now, did Thomas believe that the universe had a beginning? Of course. But he didn't believe that you could prove that through philosophical reasoning, much less science. He believed that it was simply a premise you accepted by faith. And where does he get that? From the Bible. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And Thomas just accepted this. Thomas did defend creation, but he did it what we might call negatively. That is to say, he took it as a stance of faith, and then when people brought philosophical arguments against creation, he would simply respond to those arguments. So that is my way of preface. Now again, because of Ross Hoagland, I don't have a working computer to show you my version of his argument. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to very slowly read. Ross is going to kill me when he gets back. But I'm going to read for you my version of his argument. I basically have my own little version of this argument that's in about 10 premises, 9 premises and a conclusion. And for those of you that are writing notes, I'm going to read this off slowly. Now, next week, we're probably going to be able to have a working computer with the argument up for you to see. And next week, we're actually going to look at objections to Thomas's argument. But today, we're just going to talk about the argument itself and what he was trying to prove. So before I begin, before I actually give you this argument for God's existence, what we call the Thomistic cosmological argument, if y'all have any questions about Thomas the man or anything about his theology before we proceed? No. Yes.
What caused him to start this quest of his? I mean, what was his background?
He was very good. That's a very good question. He his name is Thomas Aquinas, and so the philosophy that we ascribe to him is called Thomism. And so some people are like, well, why don't we call it Aquinianism? I mean, after all, the guy's name was Aquinas. Well, Aquinas is not really his last name. That really points to the place he came from. He came from a county called Aquino. So he is Thomas de Aquino. And he came from a very rich family. His dad was the count of the county, literally. And at a very young age, they recognized him to be a very precocious young child. And so his father said, I'm going to send my son into the ministry. Why? Because he wanted his son to be a self-sacrificial individual that would give his life for the church? No! He wanted his son to become the abbot of the local monastery, and as all of you know, in those days, if you had a high church position, you had high authority. So his father's idea was, me and my boys, Thomas had a lot of brothers, we'll control the secular things. I'll put one of my sons as the head of the abbey, and then we're going to be able to kind of run the show here. Thomas, unfortunately, he's one of those people called intellectuals, and he actually thought about things very deeply. He goes to a university called the University of Naples, and this was one of the first secular universities that was developed by Emperor Frederick in the 13th century. There were only a handful of universities at the time. And Frederick hated Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, he thought that they were all mythological. So what he was doing is he was bringing in Aristotelians. Aristotle was sort of all the rage at the time. His philosophy was rediscovered in the 12th century. And so Thomas is studying at a secular university, and he is reading Aristotle. He is also interacting with a brand new order of monks that's about close to 20 years old when he's a 15, 16, 17-year-old kid at the university.
The Franciscans?
Not the Franciscans. They were founded at the same time as Thomas's order. Thomas's order was called the Dominicans. And the Dominicans had as their battle cry to contemplate and set forth the fruits of contemplation. And so young Thomas, who was a devout man, saw these Dominicans integrating Aristotle's thought with Christianity. And Thomas became very attracted to this. He joins the Dominican order, and to show you how dedicated he was, his parents sent the brothers after him and kidnapped him and stuck him up in a tower. And to make it even worse, they sent a prostitute into the room to seduce him so that he would end up breaking his vow of chastity. And he chases the prostitute out of the room with a firebrand. And he was afraid of women. That's one of the things that we know about him. He was afraid of women. Very wise man. Afraid of women. And as he's in this room, he will not remove his habit, the dress that the Dominicans wore. And after a year, he's finally able to leave and pursue his studies. And he ends up studying under a man by the name of Albert, called Albert the Great. Albert is the theologian we would be talking about today if it weren't for Aquinas. Albert had this incredible library. He was already beginning to synthesize a lot of material, but he didn't have the mind of Aquinas to do it. Now, Aquinas, I'll say something else about Aquinas' personality. When you would ask him a question, he would spend a long time giving an answer, because he would, in his mind, think through all of the logical possibilities of the answer that he should give. And he developed a nickname. They called him the Dumb Ox. His Dominican brothers called him the Dumb Ox. And the story goes that Albert responded to that when he heard the brothers laughing at Thomas. And by the way, Thomas was a very trusting individual, so the story goes that his brothers were looking out the window and they said, "Hey, Thomas, come over here. There's a cow sitting in the tree." And Thomas ran to the window to look. And they all laughing at him, and he turned around and looked at him and said, "I would rather believe a cow sits in the tree than my Dominican brothers would ever lie to me." But Albert says about Thomas, a story goes, "Yeah, you call him the Dumb Ox now, but one day the world will hear his roar." And Thomas's goal was to take the theology of Augustine, which was the most prominent theological system that was being discussed in that day. Augustine reigned supreme in the West. And this should tell you what Ken Samples would be happy right now, because I'm talking about Augustine. Okay, everyone is standing on Augustine's shoulders, in the West at least, and the Reformation is very inspired by Augustine. And Thomas is wanting to take the theology of Augustine and integrate it with Aristotle. So if you want to summarize his theology in a nutshell, he's teaching the theology of Augustine in the terms of Aristotle. And that's Thomas in a nutshell. Yes?
Well, that's interesting that you bring up Augustine, because that's my question. I didn't read about Thomas Aquinas that much, like I said I was going to, but did he go through different stages like Augustine did? Because I have read a little bit about Augustine, and Augustine changed his theology as he grew as a person,
sure.
Right? Did
sure.
he go through that? Or
no.
Because he was in seminary, etc.
Sure.
Yeah.
No, Thomas's theology remained consistent most of his life. A favorite book the Dominicans like to promote is called the De Ante et Essentia. The translation is On Being in Essence. It's the favorite book among Thomas because it's the shortest. And basically Thomas, in a nutshell, sets out his metaphysical views. And if you look at the De Ante, which I can't remember the actual date that he wrote that in, but it was early on in his career, or you look at something like his commentaries on Seneca or Aristotle, you see consistency all the way through. You see development. You see him putting things in a different way or a different spin, but his views on God, grace, and so forth did not change much over his time.
So the mentor you spoke of, that mentor obviously had a big influence.
Huge. Yeah, Albert was very important. And in a lot of ways, you can thank three people for Thomas's work. Albert the Great for all the research. There was y'all might like this piece of trivia. There was no one really studied Greek in the 13th century, and the first person to actually become famous as a Greek scholar was a guy by the name of Hermann the German. See, sometimes history is fun because it's easy to remember. So you'll always remember Hermann the German, right? Well, Thomas had a relationship with a guy who was influenced by Hermann the German named William Morbecki. And William Morbecki translated all of Aristotle's works from Greek into Latin. Thomas, of course, knew Latin. So Thomas wrote commentaries on most of Aristotle's works. Thomas wrote commentaries on a chunk of the New Testament. Thomas also wrote commentaries on the Old Testament. And so that kind of work, you can thank William Morbecki. When you're reading through the Summa, and what you'll read is what Thomas will do is he'll ask a question that elicited a yes or no answer. Does God exist? Yes or no? And he would start off by saying, it would seem that God does not exist. Now what he's doing is he's giving you, his opponent's, answer to the question. And it would give you all the reasons that the opponents gave for God's non-existence. By the way, the two arguments that Thomas recorded for us in the Summa against God's existence were pretty much the arguments that we deal with today. Yeah. And what are they? One is evil, and two is we don't really need God as an explanation for the universe. In other words, science can explain everything. What he was dealing with then, we're dealing with now. Evil, and we don't need God as an explanation for the universe. And then he would say, on the other hand, in other words, he would just give the other answer, and then he would say, I answer as follows. And he would give you all of his arguments for God's existence, and then he would give an answer to the criticisms that were thrown back at him. And that's how the Summa Theologica reads. Blah, 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 question, yes or no answer. On the one hand, this. On the other hand, that. I answer as follows. Next question. On the one hand, this. On the other hand, that. I answer as follows. And that is 65 volumes of Thomas working his way through these questions. He synthesized all this material, and it was Albert the Great that did most of the research there, and it was his synthetic mind that was able to put it all together. I'll go ahead and finish his life for you before we start. Thomas, near the end of his life, had a religious experience that was so profound, he said, I consider all the things that I've written to become as straw. He was apparently at the Eucharist and he experienced a vision of some sort. And then on his way to, I believe it was Rome, he passed out. We think that he may have had an aneurysm. We're not really sure what happened. But he died while traveling to Rome. Some people believe he was going to Rome to be condemned because he was reading Aristotle in public and that was forbidden by the church. Some people believe he was going to be praised. Obviously, the people that like Thomas think he was going to be praised, and those who don't think he was going to be condemned. But in any case, that is how he ended his life. His life ended rather peacefully, in one sense. He didn't finish the Summa Theologica. It's an incomplete work. So that's one of the questions I'll have. Lord, why did you take Thomas before he was able to finish his work. He also, when he died, various people took parts of his body. So the Dominicans got his head and put it in to the church. His sister, one of his sisters who was a Dominican nun, got one of his fingers, and she actually kept it. So the joke is that Thomas's body experienced more adventures after his death than before his death, because, you know, he spent so much time just sort of up in that ivory tower thinking about these things. He tended to travel more post-mortem than... anyway, so... He was either 49 or 50. Young man. So, W.T. Jones, the great intellectual historian, wrote a five-volume work on the history of Western philosophy. And when he gets to Thomas Aquinas, W.T. Jones is not a Christian. He says Thomas Aquinas had the mind of a Plato and an Aristotle. My favorite line in the movie The Princess Bride? I know y'all have seen that movie. When the genius confronts the Dread Pirate Roberts, and the Dread Pirate Roberts says, so you think you're that smart, right? And so the genius says...
That's inconceivable.
Yeah, he says, let me put it to you this way. Have you ever heard of Plato, Aristotle, Socrates? And he says, yes. He goes, morons. My favorite line in that movie. Why? Because the three smartest people that ever lived were Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. And here's W.T. Jones saying Thomas Aquinas belongs in that category. He fits there. So if Christianity were a baseball team, he'd be our Babe Ruth. He was also very fat, so the analogy fits, calling him Babe Ruth. He would be hitting cleanup for us. Ken Samples was not happy when I said that to him one day. Another intellectual historian, William Durant, or Will Durant, wrote a book, just a very small book, called The Greatest Minds of All Time. And third on his list was Aquinas. And Durant apologizes to the reader because he hates Aquinas so much, because Durant is not a big fan of Christianity. But he says, I got to put this guy here because he was that intelligent. So Thomas Aquinas is the greatest mind that the church ever produced. And I'm willing to say that as a dogmatic fact. Whether you like him or don't like him, you have to deal with him. All right. So that's Aquinas. So we have about 35 minutes. Any other questions y'all want to throw at me before we actually look at his argument? Ready for the argument?
Yeah.
Now, this is a modern version. One of the problems with the arguments that he lays out in the Summa is that you'll see him lay out an argument and he'll end it with, and this everyone calls God. And yet he doesn't really tell you what kind of God he's talking about. And so people... And when I say people, you'll sit in your college classroom and you'll have some sort of anthology reader on various philosophers. And what they'll do is they'll take that one article on God's existence and hand it to the student. And the student rolls his eyes or her eyes and says, this doesn't prove anything. Who said that the unmoved mover is God, right? So the thought is, well, Thomas just lays out these arguments and... He just assumes what he doesn't have a right to assume, namely that God exists. What people don't understand is that the article doesn't really end with that article. It's the third article in the Summa. He's not finished with his point. The whole rest of his discussion on the divine attributes is his attempt to flesh out what he means by unmoved mover or uncaused cause or necessary being and so forth. So the proof for God actually lasts for about 119 articles, not just one. So think of his conclusion as a kind of laconic expression that demands more development as we move along. So modern scholars who are a fan of Thomas, what they usually like to do is they like to give you the whole enchilada in one big argument. And that's what I'm going to be doing for you today. I'm going to show you not only that an uncaused cause exists, but I would like to share with you why we should think that this is really the God of the Bible, the kind of God that is revealed in Scripture. And so I'm going to very slowly give you the premises. So you guys ready? You ready to write these down? All right. The first premise is this. At least one contingent thing undeniably exists. We're going to write this argument out slowly, and then I'm going to explain each premise. So just write the premise down. Don't question me. Just follow my orders, right? So the first premise, premise one, at least one contingent thing undeniably exists. All right. Who wants me to repeat that premise? Coolness. Premise two, that which is contingent is currently caused to exist by something other than itself. That which is contingent is currently caused to exist by something other than itself. One more time. That which is contingent is currently caused to exist by something other than itself. Who would like a repeat? That's premise two. Premise three rounds out this first step. At least one thing exists that is caused by another. At least one thing exists that is caused by another.
At least one thing exists which is caused by another.
Very good. This fourth premise is the key to the whole argument. So if you hear nothing else, hear this one. An infinite regress of contingent causes of existence is impossible. An infinite regress of contingent causes of existence is impossible. Who would like me to repeat that one? I'll do it one more time, or five more times if you do. An infinite regress of contingent causes of existence is impossible. Okay, so far so good? The fifth premise is as follows. The cause of all contingent things cannot be caused by another. The cause of all contingent things cannot be caused by another. Anybody want to repeat on that one? The cause of all contingent things cannot be caused by another. Premise number six. The cause of all contingent things cannot be self-caused. The cause of all contingent things cannot be self-caused. The cause of all contingent things cannot be self-caused. Any repeats on this?
The cause of any things cannot be self-caused.
Close. Very close. The cause of all contingent things cannot be self-caused. Hence, this is the seventh premise. There is at least one uncaused, sustaining cause of the current existence of every contingent thing in the cosmos. This is a conclusion and a premise. This is the first major conclusion. Hence, there is at least one uncaused, sustaining cause of the current existence of every contingent thing in the cosmos. I'll do it three or four more times if you like. Hence, there is at least one uncaused, sustaining cause of the current existence of every contingent thing in the cosmos. Who needs another one? Who needs it again? There is at least one uncaused, sustaining cause of the current existence of every contingent thing in the cosmos. Okay. Now, why is this our first conclusion, or why are we not finished yet? You want it again?
Isn't there an unwritten premise that time is not infinite?
I don't think that you have to assume anything about time in this argument. So no matter what your view of time is, this argument follows through. All right. So why is this our first leg of the argument? Notice I said that there's at least one uncaused cause. I'm open to the idea that there could be a million uncaused causes. In other words, I'm open to the idea of polytheism. I'm open to the idea of, I don't know what this uncaused cause is, right? There's at least one, could be more. So, but what this first sort of major conclusion gets us to is non-naturalism. We have something or some group of things that transcends the cosmos. Okay?
That's very important.
Okay. So this is the major piece of the argument. We have two more premises and then a conclusion. And this next one is a whopper. Some of you are like, golly, these premises are long. Just wait till I give this one to you. You ready for this one? We're going to do this one real slow. The uncaused cause of contingent reality, I'll repeat that one. The uncaused cause of contingent reality, one more time. The uncaused cause of contingent reality is eternal, necessary, immutable. So we got eternal, necessary, and immutable. Unlimited. Independent. Omnipotent.
Spelling test.
Yeah, spelling test. So we got eternal, necessary, immutable, unlimited, independent, omnipotent, one, O-N-E, one, not W-O-N, O-N-E, one, omnipresent.
How does he know it's immutable?
We're gonna defend each premise as we move along. So omnipotent, one, omnipresent, immaterial, omniscient. Omnipresent, immaterial, or you could say non-corporeal. Does that help? You could also say incorporeal.
Immaterial.
Omniscient. I still got a while to go. Ross Hoagland messed this up. We could have had the screen, and I'm having to lay it out for you like this. You're going to have to get on to him when he gets back. Yes?
Do you have this in print?
I do. Am I going to hand you a copy?
Yes.
No? Next week, we're going to have this argument again up for you.
Maybe.
If Ross doesn't mess things up. We'll have it up for you.
Well, we are videotaping this, right?
Yes. So we have omniscient, and have I said anything after omniscient?
No.
Truth. Now, you could use one or two words for the next attribute. All good or omnibenevolent. If you want to keep the omnis going, you can say omnibenevolent, but for those of you that don't want to write it out, just say all good. It's all good. Love, life, personal, and impassable. That's a fun one. I-M-P-A-S-S-I-B-L-E. All right, before I go forward, I'm going to just repeat these again to make sure you got them. The uncaused cause of contingent reality is eternal, necessary, immutable, unlimited, independent, omnipotent, one, omnipresent, immaterial, omniscient, truth, omnibenevolent, love, life, personal, and impassible.
What is impassible?
We're about to explain everything. Everything will be explained. Semicolon. It's like the Energizer Buddy is what this is. He is transcendent and immanent. So he is transcendent and immanent. Perfect and simple. Immense. Perfect and simple. Immense. Beautiful. Happy. Write happy down. Write it down. Incomprehensible. And yet knowable. So he is transcendent and immanent, perfect and simple, immense, beautiful, happy, incomprehensible, and yet knowable. Who wants to repeat on those last chunk of attributes? We got, you want it one more time? Where did I leave you off? All right, he is transcendent and immanent, perfect and simple, immense, beautiful, happy, incomprehensible, and yet knowable. How we doing? Next premise. We're almost there, boys and girls. We're almost there. The uncaused cause is everything. The God of classical monotheism is. No, this is the next premise.
This is nine.
The uncaused cause is everything. The God of classical monotheism is. The uncaused cause is everything. The God of classical monotheism is. One more time. The uncaused cause is everything. The God of classical monotheism is. Ha, we're there. Conclusion. Therefore, the God of classical monotheism exists. The God of classical monotheism exists. There's your argument, boys and girls. This is an argument that starts from the existence of at least one contingent thing and concludes that, therefore, the God of classical monotheism does, in fact, exist. There are no suppressed premises in this argument. Everything is laid out, and everything can be defended. Now, for those of you, we're going to spend this Sunday and next Sunday looking at this argument. For those of you that want something shorter than this, Fuzz Rana and I actually did a couple of videos on the Thomistic cosmological argument a few years ago, so you can find that on YouTube. For those of you that want something more detailed, my little apologetics crew, I did 14 hours of study on this one argument. Seven sessions, if you will. And so if you want to learn how you can listen to it only, you don't have to do anything else, you can go to Sermon Audio. You can download that app for Sermon Audio. Type my name in, and that'll come up. Northgate Presbyterian Church has a feature there, and you can find all of my lectures on apologetics, and there are seven on the Thomistic cosmological argument. For those of you who want the written material, you can see me after class, and we can talk about that. But what we're going to do, this is sort of an in-between. This is between the real short stuff that I did with Fuzz Rana and what I've also done in other contexts. So let's go through each premise very quickly, and sometimes we'll stop and go very slowly. At least one contingent thing exists. What is a contingent thing? Well, something is contingent just in case it is changing, finite or limited, and dependent upon something else for its existence.
That's the definition
of a contingent thing. Anything that you come across that is contingent is going to have those three features. Let me give me as an example. I am contingent. How do I know that I'm contingent? Well, I once didn't know what the word contingent meant. Therefore, I am changing. I am very limited in a lot of capacities. I'm not back home in Albany, Georgia right now as I speak. I'm here. I'm limited in with regard to space. I'm limited in knowledge. Not only did I learn what the word contingent means, I don't know a whole lot of stuff about a whole lot of things. I don't know astronomy like Hugh Ross does. And Hugh Ross will probably be the first to tell you that there's a lot he doesn't know about the very thing that he... I know that's hard to believe, isn't it? There's some things that Hugh Ross doesn't know. But he is constantly learning about astronomy. And when he's not learning about that, he's learning about the other sciences. So all of us are limited in knowledge. We're changing. And we depend upon things for our existence. We depend on sunlight and food and water and community and shelter. So every day as you're walking around, you're proving that you're a contingent thing. You move from here to there and you eat and you're like, I really need some rest. The fact that you need something proves that you could be other than what you are. And that leads me to my second definition of a contingent thing. This is the more philosophical one. The first one sounds more practical, doesn't it? A contingent thing is just something that is limited and changing and dependent upon another. The more philosophical definition picks up where that leaves off and says that every contingent thing that you encounter is going to be composed of two attributes. And here they are, actuality and potentiality. Everything that you encounter will actually exist, but have the potential to be something other than what it is. Okay? I actually exist, but I have the potential to be other than I am. I have the potential to have one arm instead of two, or no legs, or for my hair to get thinner than it's already getting, or for me to lose weight, which I desperately need to do. So I have the potential in me to be other than what I am. I also have the potential to not exist. So a contingent thing is a composition of actuality and potentiality. In other words, it is composed of actuality and potentiality and therefore can not exist.
Are you talking about humans only?
No, anything you encounter. Pick it, that car I'm looking at outside, or the chairs in this room. Everything that I encounter is composed of actuality and potentiality. Now, all that I need for this argument to work is for one thing to be contingent. All I need is a single contingent thing, and the whole argument goes through. But I think I can point out lots of contingent things in my experience. All of you, the chairs you're sitting in, anything we encounter in our life is composed of actuality and potentiality. How are we doing?
Yep.
So far, so good? Yes.
Could our soul not exist at some point?
Yes. I'm appealing to atheists here, so we're not assuming that humans have souls, right? But if the human soul exists, it could not exist, right? So the human soul need not exist. Everything about you is a maybe. It ain't a must be. The world can get along just fine without you. I know that's hard for some people to believe. But the world can get along, reality can get along just fine without you. When, according to Christianity, when we go to heaven, will we be contingent beings then? Yes, we will be contingent for all eternity. What about the angels? Are the angels composed of actuality and potentiality? Yes. From the highest angel to an amoeba to the smallest quark, everything that you encounter in your reality that is a creature is a composition of actuality and potentiality.
Some of the atheists I've run across, they actually think that contingency will disappear and they'll become God, which is just really fallacious.
Oh, of course. And here's one of the things that you need to understand about metaphysics. Once you are something, you will always be that kind of something. So once contingent, always contingent. The one thing about you that will never change is your contingency. You will never evolve into something metaphysically transcendent with respect to what you are right now.
So God
is that's either good news or bad news. We will get to God in a moment. We're just talking about us. We're just talking about things we encounter. Yes.
So then I can summarize and say that any uncaused thing is a contingent thing.
Any uncaused thing is a contingent thing? I'm going to actually argue that the uncaused cause is not contingent. Anything that is caused to be must be contingent, and any contingent thing must be caused. So that's the next premise, isn't it? Whatever is contingent is caused to be by another. And we've already proven that just in this exploration that we've done already. Everything that we encounter is contingent, and part of the definition of contingency is dependency. If you're contingent, you are dependent. And if you depend on another for your existence, then there must be another that causes you to be. So right now, there are a group of causes that keep me in existence right now as we speak. So you're a contingent thing in the sense that you right now as we speak need a sustaining cause to keep you in existence. Which leads us to our third premise. There is at least one thing that is being caused by another. Okay. Now, how are we doing so far? We got to the third premise pretty quick there.
Do you consider this proof, absolute proof?
I'm absolutely convinced that God exists, and if I had no other reason, this argument would do it. I don't have probability that God exists. I have certainty. Now, I'm an idiot in most academic circles because people don't think that these arguments prove anything, but we'll look at the objections next week, but this is proof.
But this is a logical argument.
We'll look at the objections and I'll show you what critics have said to it, but yeah, it's a very good point to make. This has been around 800 years, and I've noticed that most of the objections to theism Thomas answered 800 years ago.
Sure.
All right, how are we doing so far? All right, by the way, this third premise, there's at least one thing that is caused by another, that proves that there are two things in existence. We've just refuted a worldview, namely solipsism. Have y'all heard of solipsism? Solipsism is the belief that you're the only thing that exists. And congratulate. Solipsists, by the way, have had a hard time writing books. They don't do well with book writing because they want others to read the book. Four. Here's the most important of the premises. An infinite regress of contingent causes of existence is impossible. Now, here's what I am not saying here, and here's what no Thomas that I'm aware of is saying. We're not saying that it's impossible for an actually infinite number of things to exist. That is not what is being claimed here. Okay, is that clear? So, it could be the case that there are an infinite number of contingent things. And even if I granted that for the sake of argument, I would still have to say that this infinite regress is impossible. When I deny an infinite regress, what I'm saying is it is impossible for the regress of contingent causes to exist in such a way that there's nothing outside of it giving it existence. So even if there are an infinite number of them, there must be something outside of that contingent series giving an existence. Okay? So let's just walk through this very slowly. Let's assume that there's only a finite number of contingent things. Okay? Let's just have that assumption. Well, if you say there's a finite number of them, then there must be something outside of the series giving it existence. So imagine you have chains, links on a chain, and that's a finite number of links, and it's being suspended in the air, and you ask yourself the question, how is this chain being suspended in the air? Well, you would have to appeal to something that is not a link, right? Like a hook on the wall? Okay. So So far, so good. See, that was too easy. So the atheist says, what if there's an infinite number of them? Well, even if there's an infinite number of them, there still has to be something outside of that series giving it existence. Why? Because if every member of the series is contingent, what is the whole?
Contingent.
Oh, well, that's an existential question that we will not explore here today. But if every member of a contingent series, even if the number of those contingent beings is infinite, if every member is contingent, then the whole is contingent too. Now, the cause of the whole series of contingent things cannot be contingent. Now, you answer me that. Why can't it be contingent? Right. It wouldn't be the cause of the whole series, would it? It would be a part of the series. That too would need a cause. So the only way you can make sense out of the fact that the whole series needs a cause is to say it's grounded in something that is uncaused.
One cause, right?
We don't know yet. Okay. Could be an infinite number of causes. Okay. But we know that there's at least one uncaused cause of this contingent series. Now at this point, a lot of atheists are going to say, time out. You're assuming a contingent series. How do you know that these contingent things cause each other? Maybe every single contingent thing that exists is distinct, existing by itself, and totally not caused by any other contingent thing. So all contingent things just sort of exist as their own little island universes, separated from every contingent thing. Who are you to say that any contingent thing causes another contingent thing? At that point, it's game, set, match for the atheist. Why? Because every contingent thing needs a cause. And therefore, if no contingent thing causes another contingent thing, then the cause of every contingent thing immediately is an uncaused cause. Yeah. Now, we still don't know how many uncaused causes there are, do we? Oh, well, as long as there's an uncaused cause, I guess it wouldn't be chaos. But most atheists believe that contingent things, that the law of causality kind of comes and goes. And so they do advocate a kind of chaos where contingent things just exist without a cause. I mean, the bottom line is your average atheist wants to believe that there's something out there that's contingent that doesn't need a cause. But I quote Immanuel Kant, if we assume that a thing is contingent, then it is analytically true to say that it has to have a cause. Okay. Yes?
Would it be equivalent to say that uncaused is self-existent?
Yes, we're going to get to that. And yeah, an uncaused thing would be a self-existent being. How are we doing? Yes?
Supposing you had, instead of just links, they were linked into a chain that was like a necklace.
Mm-hmm.
So each contingent thing was
very
circular.
Good. Okay. Now you're thinking. This is good. Why have a linear series or even a causally disparate series? Why don't we just put them in a circle? Let me ask you this. If I jump out of an airplane and I don't have a parachute, and the question is, what's going to keep me from dying? And I say, I grab onto my friend, who's also falling with me. But it turns out that he doesn't have a parachute either. Well, then we two grab onto another guy and another guy and another guy and say, well, God, this line that we have, we're heading to the ground pretty quick. Let's get in a circle. That circle is going to keep us from dying, is it? A contingent series and a circle, a line, separate, that will not explain its existence. And here's what's worse, and this leads us to the next premise about the cause of contingent things can't be self-caused. If you have a circle and you say that that circle explains itself on a kind of causal loop, then what you're advocating is the idea of a self-caused series of things. Now, if you think about it, nothing can be self-caused. Why? Because to be self-caused means you have to exist before you exist. And that's a contradiction.
So
So the cause of contingent reality can't be contingent, but the cause of contingent reality cannot be self-caused either. And you only have three options here: contingent, self-caused, or uncaused. That's it. And we've ruled out the other two, and that means that the uncaused cause has to exist and serves as a cause of all contingent reality. Yes?
As I go back to the self-caused cause or the uncaused cause, whatever we want to look at it, I come into a world of the unknown, which I think is important because we can talk about nothing if we know that nothing is what does not exist about what we understand. If I don't understand something, it becomes unknown. If I say there's nothing there, then I have to know about something to say that something's not there and there's nothing of it there. Okay? But
right.
Now, when I come to the unknown, I come to a posteriori inductive reasoning to an unknown. And I can call that unknown by inductive reasoning someone who has power greater than humankind over his affairs and call that God. But I like what you said about his last part of life, he had an experience with God, because, and he considered it, his other things in comparison as strong, because if it's the unknown, and we're guessing or making conjectures about it, that unknown, if it actually brings experience to us from the unknown, and reveals itself as greater through prophecy or other things, I find that more satisfying about the unknown revealing itself to me.
So, I'm not sure, are you objecting to the argument?
I guess I object to the argument of being the best argument. I think the best argument is experience from the unknown to us.
Well, I guess I would say several things about that. First, I don't think that Thomas was discounting his argument in saying what he said. I think he clearly had a religious experience that is far more confirmatory for him.
No, I didn't say discounting.
Right, you know, I'm obviously not saying that this is the only way that we can come to know God. I would agree with William Lane Craig, who says that there are many warrants for God's existence. One would be our personal experience with Christ, and others would be these kinds of arguments that confirm for us that God exists. But when you say you have an experience of the unknown and you call it God, how do you know that that unknown is God?
The way I know, for instance, prophecy, and I like the creation story a lot, because they are measured according to standards, let's take the standard of math or time. And those prophecies, some of them are measured to the day, and they actually take place beyond the control of humans later on to the day. And that is an experience
right.
Beyond my control. Someone greater than humanity has actually controlled history. That I call God.
How does that discount this argument, though?
It doesn't get discounted again, but it makes it less valuable to me or less satisfying
okay.
than the actual experience.
Okay. Well, thank you. Yes.
You started out with what we know about the characteristics of this cause.
Yeah.
To just forget about the first set of premises is going to be confusing if you just jump ahead to the third argument. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Some individuals want to jump too quickly into the kind of uncaused cause that exists, and others want to just hang out at establishing an uncaused cause.
Yeah, like how do you know they throw that at you?
How do you know this is God?
Yeah.
So what this argument does is it brings both sets together. So we've established an uncaused cause of all contingent reality, and now we're going to ask the question, how do we know that this uncaused cause is, in fact, God? I think that we're ready to jump into that, right? Some of you want to know why this uncaused cause is happy. Right. Yes?
I think you'd have to say these are arguments that are kind of assembled on our understood framework of time. Linear and non-reversible.
And yes.
For anybody to refute these arguments, they actually have to demonstrate the reality of a different time framework, don't they?
I would challenge anybody that says that Thomas is wrong and who would say, well, he's assuming a certain view of time, and therefore I dismiss his view of time, and therefore I can dismiss the argument. To that person, I would say, what version of time?
You have to demonstrate what time you're talking about, which conceptually doesn't even really exist for people to conjecture about.
Okay, but what I'm saying is, what conception of time are you trying to use to refute the argument? And I would probably be able to argue that regardless of what conception of time that they're talking about, the argument still follows through even if I accepted that conception of time.
You have to demonstrate you can take me to the alternate time.
Well, I'll give you, and I'm not going to explain the views of time because we have 15 minutes, and I do want to get into the attributes. But there are two main conceptions of time now: the B theory and the A theory. And I've seen evidence that Thomas was a B theorist, and this is a little anachronistic because he didn't enter into this discussion, but I've seen evidence that he's a B theorist. I've also seen evidence that he was an A theorist. And what that shows me is that Thomas's view of reality is congenial with whatever view of time you want to talk about. So I'm unplushed by the B theory of time when it comes to this. I'm unplushed by the A theory of time when it comes to this. The argument works. Remember, if this argument is sound, the universe could still be eternal. That means that Hugh Ross and RTB, they're all wrong. And you still have a proof for God's existence on this view. So even if the universe has existed forever, there still has to be a God who's always sustained it. All right, y'all ready for the attributes? Okay. So the uncaused cause of contingent reality is eternal. Well, if the universe is eternal, that's what we're assuming, and God help the atheist who says, no, time out. I think that the universe had a beginning. Oh, okay. Great. I'm more than happy to have that discussion, right? So I'm not going to be hurt if the atheist says, no, I think the universe had a beginning. Don't you believe in Big Bang cosmology? I would say, yeah. Really? You think the universe had a beginning? Well, now we have an even a greater proof for God's existence, right? So that doesn't hurt. Well, if the universe is eternal and it has eternally required a cause for its existence, then the cause of the universe must be eternal too. Because if you eternally require a cause, you have to have an eternally sufficient cause to explain the eternally existent universe. So this cause is eternal. This cause is also necessary, and the best way to explain this is as follows. You'll remember that every contingent thing that you come in contact with is a combination of actuality and potentiality. Well, if you think about it, everything that could exist is either purely potential or a combination of actuality and potentiality or pure actuality with no potentiality. Right? So is the uncaused cause purely potential? No, because if it were purely potential, it wouldn't exist. It would be a pure potential. But we've already shown that the uncaused cause exists, and therefore it is not purely potential. Well, is it a combination of actuality and potentiality? No, because if it were, then it would be a contingent thing that needs a cause. But it doesn't need a cause. Therefore, this being is pure actuality with no potentiality whatsoever. And because this being is pure actuality with no potentiality whatsoever, then that means it doesn't have the potential to change. It's immutable. It doesn't have the potential for non-existence. That means it's necessary, self-existent, right? Because it is not a combination of actuality and potentiality, it is independent. Okay? So what we have is an independent, unchanging, necessary, and we also have this being as unlimited. Who could place limits on that which is pure actuality? If you could, then that means it would be a caused being, right? But if you can't place limits on it, then it is unlimited. So it is also infinite, yes.
Desires fellowship with us, so there's a certain attachment or emotional incompleteness, but yet by definition it seems like your premise is saying he's complete.
Well, let me skip to the attribute called impassible. I am going to argue that this cause has emotions and therefore has desires, but those desires are in no way contingent upon the creature. So God's love for me is a fully free love. Now, for those of you that would like an analogy of this, you know, if you think about it, have you ever heard people come up to you and say, "I love you unconditionally"? That's a lie. Okay? Unconditional love between two equals is impossible. There's a reason why I love my wife. Okay, I love my wife because she's beautiful and she's kind and she's sweet, but I also love her because she said I do at the altar. If I were standing there at the altar and she never showed up, I wouldn't be loving her right now. My love for my wife is conditional. Her love for me is conditional.
I've heard of mothers saying to their children, "I love you unconditionally."
Okay, very, very good. So the only person that can actually love another person unconditionally is a greater to a less. So a perfect analogy is a parent to a child. That baby did nothing for you. And if you're a mother, that baby has only hurt you so far, right? And yet, you became smitten with that child right from the get-go, and you love that child unconditionally. And that is our first analogy with God. We have our closest analogy with God when we become parents, because that's the only time we've ever loved someone unconditionally.
And we would die for that child.
Exactly. And why does your child love you? Does your child love you unconditionally? No, the only reason your child loves you is because you first loved that child. There's a verse. Yeah. We love because he first loved us. None of us love God unconditionally. Why would we? We love only because God first loved us. Does God have emotions? You bet. But are God's emotions towards us, as Paul asks, what do we have that we haven't received? What can we give to God that he doesn't already have? So, well, he's full of love. And the only reason we love him is because he first loved us. So even if we say, "I love you, God," the only reason we're doing that is because he first gave it to us. What do we have that we haven't received from God? Nothing. And therefore, yeah, God does love. He does have an emotional life, but his love is in no way dependent upon the creature. And so, is God wholly self-contained? You bet. He doesn't need you in any way, shape, or form. There's nothing about you that God needs, but God does desire you, and that's what makes his grace so amazing, right? Now, going back to our distillation of the attributes. God is also omnipotent. We just showed that God is unlimited. This uncaused cause is unlimited. But if this uncaused cause is unlimited, we also have to say that this uncaused cause has abilities or power. How do we know that this uncaused cause has power? Because this uncaused cause has the power to sustain the universe in existence. But if the uncaused cause has power, then it has unlimited power. This uncaused cause is omnipotent. This uncaused cause is omnipresent. Existence entails location. So the uncaused cause has to exist somewhere, but the uncaused cause is unlimited, and therefore the uncaused cause has to exist everywhere, omnipresently. And anything that is omnipresent can't be contained in space, right? This podium is a material thing, and the reason I know it is a material thing is because it is contained in a specific location. But I just showed you that the uncaused cause cannot be contained in a specific location, and therefore the uncaused cause must be omnipresent. And therefore the uncaused cause must also be immaterial. The Mormons are wrong. God is not a being who lives on the planet Kolob in the middle of our galaxy. Now, Hugh has shared with you how scientifically impossible that is. I'm showing you how metaphysically impossible it is, because if God is truly omnipresent, then God cannot be made up of a soul and a body. God is pure spirit.
Yeah, he wouldn't be eternal if he
That is also true.
But you need to put God in that frame if you want to be your own God.
Yes, that's true. Now, the uncaused cause is also omniscient. Knowledge is power, if you think about it. And if God is all-powerful, he must therefore have some knowledge. But you can't place limits on his attributes, and therefore this God is all-knowing. And because this God knows all truths, this God must be truth itself. Yes?
Well, if God is omnipotent, in addition to being a spirit, he could also have a body.
He could acquire a body, but that doesn't mean his essence is material. This being is also omnibenevolent. Can this being be a mixture of good and evil? How do we know this? Well, if you think about evil, evil is a privation of the good. Evil is kind of like blindness in the eye. The eye is not evil, but what the eye lacks is evil. It's not what it's supposed to be. Therefore, he who is pure actuality with no potentiality must be pure goodness. All good or omnibenevolent. This being demonstrates his love for us and that he sustains us in existence. This being chooses to do so. I'm not defending these as well as I could, but we're pressed for time. Therefore, this being is living. And this being must therefore be personal, because if you're an omniscient mind who also has an emotional life and you have a will, then that makes you a personal being. And the rest becomes very simple. This being is transcendent with respect to us, but also immanent because he's omnipresent. This being is perfect because you can't add anything to him to make him more of what he is. He already is whatever he needs. And this being is also simple. Now, I want to spend maybe 1 minute on the attribute of simplicity. This is an attribute that's being hotly debated now in academic circles. But a simple being is one that is uncomposed in any way, shape, or form. I am complex, right? And how am I complex? I'm complex because I'm a composition of matter and form. I have two arms. Now, my complexity is proven by the fact that if you cut off one of my arms, I am now lacking an arm, but I'm still me. Okay? God is simple in the sense that he is literally everything he has. So he doesn't have the property of power. He is power. He doesn't have the property of goodness. He is goodness. If he had his properties, then he could lose them. Right? Kind of like I have an arm and I can lose it. So think of God not as a being who, and this is why God is extremely impossible to comprehend. God, when we think of God, we don't just add up his attributes together and say, these things collectively make God, God. No, rather, all of these attributes are one in him. This is why we can't really fully conceive of his essence. So he is simple. Yes?
Sorry, how does this be supported by Trinity view of God?
Yeah, how do I answer that in 1 minute? I will say this. I do have some talks on this. So if you want to listen to my thing on the Trinity, the question is, how do you reconcile simplicity with Trinity? If God is absolutely simple, then how can God be Father, Son, and Holy Spirit from eternity? And I do a series on this, and I actually try to reconcile that. But I'll throw out a line.